Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Frontside Podcast, episode 34. I'm Charles, and I'm here with, who am I here? Who are you?
I'm Brandon. Do you remember me from earlier podcasts?
Man, it's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. We haven't done a true dadcast in the classic sense, probably, what, for 5 or 6 months?
Yeah, something like that.
Too long,
definitely,
my friend.
In about as many episodes.
Yeah. It's been good. I really enjoyed listening to the last episode. I learned a lot from listening to you and Lydia and Alex talk about immutability, a subject which bored me out of the entire podcast, but it was enjoyable to listen to. So y'all did a great job. And the idea of like pivoting that toward literate programming, I can get behind everything I heard on that. I thought it was really cool. So it made me really honestly like a little bowled over at how capable and amazing the people here are. I don't want them to feel.
I know, right?
Yeah, I don't want, that might come as like a left-handed compliment or whatever. Like, wow, I'm really impressed by how smart you are. But like, it was, I don't know. I don't know why I did that. Came kind of out of left field, but it was really cool to learn.
No. I had the same thing. I actually listened to that podcast and I was like, wow, you know, so reasoned, so measured, so full of great information.
Mm-hmm. And that was just you.
I know.
It's me listening to myself.
Here we are again.
I wanted to get one more podcast in at the end of the year as sort of like a year in review I don't know. I'm leaving for taking a couple weeks off at the end of the year, which I'm excited about. But I felt like I didn't want to leave it without a little bit of reflection. And so,
yeah, we did it last year. It was good. It's nice to have a nice setup and teardown to bookend the year.
Yeah. And next year we'll test drive the year. So we'll actually say what we learned in 2016 at the beginning of the year and then work towards achieving that.
Yeah. Well, you know, test driving is maybe not even that inappropriate of an analogy. I think, you know, we talked about doing a roundup of things we learned this year. And I think that one of the biggest things for me has been introducing programming practices into kind of the way that we run, you know, the way I run my life or the way that I run my kind of daily practice, certainly in business. I'm still a mess in my personal life. I'm completely and totally unstructured, and that's good. And that's the way it should be. But one of my key takeaways, one of the things I started doing back in October, was trying to do a write-up of what it is that my day was going to look like for my own benefit. So in the spirit of TDD, saying, I'm going to be deliberate about this. I'm going to look at the day in front of me. I'm going to look at the tasks that I have to do, and I'm going to write out in prose a plan. So it's kind of like a cucumber test for my day. And then that becomes something that, you know, I can save and I can review later. I started trying to do like a kind of a retrospective at the end of each day. It turned out to be a little bit too much, but not only did it do such a great job of gelling and organizing my thoughts, it was immediately broadcastable. So that I could then take that information and share it with the rest of the team to kind of see where, they could see where I was. And if there was something that was just, you know, wildly off course, be like, no. That's not feasible today. We've got this. So that was kind of interesting, but I felt like it made me feel more, to connect to last week's podcast, more literate about my day and more like I'm doing, you know, behavior-driven behavior.
So do you think Kent Beck doesn't give enough like credit to Benjamin Franklin for like inventing that principle? Like Kent Beck gets all the credit for like TDD type stuff. And then really like, come on, that's Benjamin Franklin.
Really?
Well, yeah. Like, have you ever read that stuff about Benjamin Franklin, how he like planned his whole crap out? Maybe that's like unique to people from Utah, because they got steeped in that whole crazy Stephen Covey business during the 80s and 90s.
Stephen Covey. Yeah. That one just went over my head.
Wow, really? Stephen Covey was like, wrote the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And,
he invented this day planner
company. And he would always like, and he literally was called Franklin Quest. So it was like everything about like Benjamin Franklin's like whole like day planning, the whole day planner craze came from this Covey dude who was sort of obsessed with Franklin's style. With
Benjamin Franklin? Yeah. Really? So Ben Franklin actually would do the same thing?
Yeah, in weird ways that Franklin was a weird dude and kind of a philanderer. So sort of like I don't know, troubadour in modern day. I don't know. It would be a good guy to study. I haven't seen any really good biopics of him. And you could
of Benjamin Franklin.
He invented the daily, you know, stand up, and also loved French women. So interesting cat, that Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah, I'm sure that was part of his day planner too.
I don't know. Do you pencil that in? Like carouse 4 hours? Are you sure, Ben? Oh, I'll have plenty of wine for this evening. So yeah, and I also congratulate you on managing to scrub all of those like daily things where you write them personally and then put them in our public like stand-up channel in Slack.
Yeah,
scrub that of anything like Brandon has disappointed me in the following ways.
yet again. Why I persist in my hope.
So are we declaring that one of the things you learned in 2015, that that's a valuable practice?
I think so. You know, it's one of those things where I decided to try it on a lark. And if something sticks with you in a frictionless way, I think it's safe to say that it's something that works for you and something that you learned. So in the sense that I've come to depend on it, I'm a little bit grumpy if I don't get a chance to do it. Or grumpy in the sense that I don't...
You're discombobulated.
Yeah, I'm discombobulated. I'm not entirely at ease if I haven't gotten a chance to do it. And in fact, if there's a project or something, or something that requires, you know, meetings early and first thing in the morning, a lot of times before I have a chance to do this, then yeah, it just completely and totally throws off my whole day. And I have to stop at, you know, at 11:30, 12 and make sure that I do it. I don't get around it. I just have to do it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then when you sort of pitched it to the team as like, hey, this is working for me, maybe it will work for you. And I was like, yeah, why don't you just take a hike? Because I had this sort of push down my throat at lots of different places where there's like the sort of forced daily stand-up, or even before that, at many points in my life, including my dad, tried to like have me like plan my day out before my day starts. And it never really clicked for me, but kind of watching you by example manage to... sort of like wrangle the insanity and then forcing myself to sit down and write like, wow, I'm responsible for a lot of crap. Here's all the stuff I actually have to get done today. And there's no way that's going to happen. And so if I could like, if two or three,
right. So you have
things,
you're forced to de-scope, yep, right?
Yeah. If two of these three things got done today or even this week, this will be a successful week. Mm-hmm. It really does take a lot of that, a lot of the sense of hecticness out of your life. If you can kind of give yourself that broader perspective.
Yeah, no, definitely. It definitely does. And I think, you know, it's in kind of clinging to that last bit that you mentioned there, I've actually noticed that through this practice and through, you know, other things that I've taken on by watching other people of the team, just how much you have to do, you have to repeat something. It's one thing to kind of proselytize a practice and say, you should do this and you should do this and you should do this. And you can just argue and talk to people and say that they should do it and, you know, talk about how effective it is. But there's no substitute for just doing it in close proximity to somebody and then let them learn from it, from just seeing it modeled. So, for example, like Alex has that thing with the calendar. And, you know, he obviously was very wanted to advocate setting up the Slack bot to like integrate the calendar so that it would notify people of important events and being able to, you know, put stuff on the calendar and have the Slack bot remind people. And I was kind of, yeah, sounds like a good idea. Maybe, you know, okay, but not really. And then he did it. And then I was, oh, that's kind of cool. And, you know, but he kept on entering stuff into the calendar. So there were a lot of times where I might have used it, but didn't. But he just kept on entering different events and like sticking with the practice because he really believed in it. And finally, I was able to see, okay, that's actually kind of valuable. And it overcame my skepticism. And, you know, I think he was doing it for 6 weeks almost before I was finally like, okay, just show me how to do this. And like, he told me how to do it before, but it was the practice didn't stick until I said, okay, I want to do that. You show me how to do that. Does that make sense?
So totally. And I think so, to kind of boil it, is like trying to evangelize a good idea is basically impossible, because all you can do is keep at it long enough to have every person that you want to adopt it see it bear fruit for somebody that in a way that they can relate to. So like that hasn't quite clicked for me, but it's close, that calendar thing, watching people. Right. But there's like as other people start seeing it bear fruit in a different way, like, hey, listen, it's really nice to have people know when you're going to be on vacation. And we've never really had that be formal. That's kind of irritating. And so watching that start to bear fruit for other people creates a sort of like vacuum that pulls you into a practice rather than trying to get behind and push. Basically, you can pretty much guarantee that that's going to fail. Like if you have to get out behind a practice and push, be prepared for that to fail. And so the process, there's a whole book about this that a friend of mine referred me to. I forget the name of it, but the subtitle is like How to Change When Change is Hard. And it uses this whole metaphor about the writer and the elephant, and getting people to like make positive changes in their life means that you have this like writer who's logical and has the capacity to steer. But the thing with all the power, and if it decides to do its own thing, is the emotion. If it decides to do its own thing, it's going to do its own thing. It's like a rider and an elephant, like good luck. Mm-hmm. So you have to like gently lead this elephant, like catch the attention of the person that's riding it. Sure. But like you have to steer the elephant or you can't get the rider.
Right. Right. And if you can get that elephant moving in the right direction, then there's a large amount of momentum and things can feel easy, not to abuse the metaphor, but yeah, I think if you can generate genuine desire in people rather than like explain something to them. I guess explanations don't really generate desire. Like, but if you see somebody with, you know, who just runs by with rocket skates or like shoots by with rocket skates every day, you're like, man, I got to get me some of those.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So that's cool. Like it's been fun to see. It had that sort of pull effect on me. I can actually tell that my day is not going to be very, I'm not setting myself for a super productive day if I can't think clearly enough in the morning to write down what's actually supposed to happen that day. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not mm-hmm. like, okay, well, prepare to be acted upon for 8 hours.
Right. Prepare to be buffeted by the requirements of your life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, there was a love hook. You would have actually seen it coming if you'd bothered to write it down.
I think that lesson is so close to the one that I was going to do that I don't think it bears much further discussion, which is, but is that all you want to discuss around that? Or
yeah, okay. That's all. I was actually going to segue into something that, you know, be what you're about to talk about.
Gavel. I'll allow it.
Oh, you're saying, okay.
I'll allow the segue.
You'll allow the segue. Yes.
Overruled. Enter my chambers. That's all I got. That's all the judge talk I know.
I thought you were saying gabble, gabble, gabble like Hamburglar. And I was like, I don't catch
robble,
it.
Robble. Man,
that's robble,
robble. Man. Get up on your McDonald, man. I heard people in a different podcast.
Get your disyllabic nonsense straight, son.
Well, I heard a different podcast talking about the McDonaldland characters, and it really bothered me that they didn't understand that the origin was from H.R. Puff and Stuff folks. And like that whole thing. That
bothers me too. Actually, it might bother me that you know what H.R. Puffin folk stuff is. What are we talking about?
Well, I grew up in Dallas-Fort Worth, and the H.R. Puffin stuff characters were still active. Like there was still like remnants of that floating around Six Flags Over Texas. And then you go back and watch the old videos from the 70s, and all their cavorting happened at Six Flags.
Really?
Yeah, it's
H.R. Puffin stuff?
Yeah, go back and watch it. It's also kind of disturbing. There's something very disturbing about the whole motif.
So like Grimace I always wondered what the hell Grimace was doing in a burger.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
What did Grimace have to do with the, I mean, Mayor McCheese?
Yeah, I mean,
that makes sense.
I'll buy sentient
hamburger,
talking hamburgers.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm your mayor. I'm delicious. Okay, I guess. And the French fries are like multicolored. I don't know what's going on with any of it. It's all a pretty bad acid trip, but it just at least recognize the connection to H.R. Puffin stuff is all I ask.
Okay, H.R. Puffin stuff.
Before this
truly.
Tangent, you wanted to take us on a different one. So we should rewind.
Oh, well, I was just saying it's another practice that I've also become completely dependent on in a very good way, where if it doesn't happen, you know, I start to feel discombobulated and discomfited and, you know, want to make sure that we get back on track to where we're doing it. And that is the whole, not retrospective, but the whole kind of feedback cycle that we've developed here of constantly talking with, you know, our people in terms of their organizational role mm-hmm. and making sure that, you know, nothing gets assumed and that everybody's on the same page in terms of, you know, role of the company and things that they're doing.
Yeah, that lesson has landed everywhere from like a whisper in the ear to a sledgehammer to the head throughout the course of this year.
Yeah, it really, it's like amazing that we managed to do without it for as long as we did. And it's been, I think it's been, you know, it's been, one could say that 2015 was the year that that process became formalized. But it became, I think it was, you know, it was the same type of deal where, you know, you just kind of started doing it. And I don't know, where did that come from? Where did the impetus to start that come from?
Oh, man, I don't know. I'm sure I stole it from somewhere. Are you talking about the one-on-one stuff or the way that we do it?
Yeah, the way that we do it, the one-on-one stuff, and kind of that whole process, because
I don't know. I've never like seen it done well. And so it just mm-hmm. felt like the right thing to do. That we were like losing touch with people. And I think it probably came, man, somebody, hopefully our employees still listen to this podcast, even the Dadcast ones, and they'll be like, no, that was me. And they'll have us appropriately credit whoever it was that said, hey, why aren't we sitting down and talking about this periodically? I don't remember how that all went down. And
it seems like insanity
that we never did.
That we never did.
Yeah. I've seen other people that I like and respect do this process, but I've never experienced it in a way that I've considered positive until we've done it here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me neither.
Of holding one-on-ones in such a way that sort of upholds our values system and isn't just like a check-in, like, hey, everything good? Yeah, everything's good. Okay, see ya. That's been my experience with one-on-ones because people don't really have, and so I guess this was the year that I learned that I'm a framework designer. It's just that I like designing frameworks for human interaction rather than.
I think that's 100% accurate because so much of it feels like sound engineering practice and like establishing these cadences and these rhythms and you know, having algorithms by which you flesh out these issues.
I should probably describe this little mini framework. I'm quite sure I've stolen it from somewhere, but it sort of. I think I read a blog post about this before, and it lined up with the idea of autonomy, mastery, and purpose from mm-hmm. Dan Pink's Drive. And it was employees want three things. And it's to know, all right, as a company, where are we going? What's my role in it? And how am I doing? And with that, people can feel confident that they know how they're doing in their job at a given time. And it seems like every month is enough to check in on that without disrupting the flow of work. And but also without losing touch for too long. And our experience is a monthly is a pretty good cadence for that, unless something, you know, there's additional strain, like somebody's brand new or something like that. And but for us, that doesn't really reflect our value system because the company exists to serve its employees. So we flip it and say, okay, well then also, in addition to those three questions, where are you going in your career? What's the front side's role in it? And how is the front side doing at it? And that little mini framework, just writing that, those six, you know, a reference to those six questions on a little piece of paper every month with people and being authentic about those things and checking back in on them and then you like action stuff falls out of that. You go, okay, well, you say you want to speak at conferences. Let's find some conferences to submit proposals to this month. That kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I have to say it's been transformational for me even that being able to flip it out. I think the first time that I went through that review process, kind of, there was definitely this moment where I was able to separate my own identity from the identity of the company and see myself as an employee of this company, even though I started it, being able to step back from that and say, I am now, you know, being able to see myself as just a part of it and kind of visualize my role in it and see what is the role of this entity in my life was so healthy. I can't even begin to describe how good that felt.
Yeah. And that reminds me that what are we like 4 weeks late on yours and mine?
Yeah.
it's the yeah, chef eats last, cobbler's children, et cetera, et cetera.
Go unshod. Yeah.
But
the Cooper's children ride around without barrels.
But you can't. And so like this all kind of rolls up into that lesson. And I would say I would summarize it as if you don't protect your breathing room to focus and ponder, you will stand to lose everything you're working toward. You just have to protect that breathing room, and it's going to feel people are going to put the kind of put pressure on you to do everything to take it away from yourself. You're going to put that pressure on yourself. People will put it on you. Mm-hmm. And you absolutely have to protect that.
Yeah. You will go nowhere if you're feeling rushed.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest red flag. If you're so constrained and your time and your attention are so constrained that you're rushing around doing stuff, you're just going to be making mistake after mistake. And unless you stop, those are going to be compounded exponentially. It makes sense, right? It's the same way that we approach software, is to be very thoughtful, and very mindful, about how it's constructed. And so why wouldn't that apply to how we conduct the rest of our business? Because ultimately it's all part of the same. Those two things are not really separate. They're all part of the same process, mm-hmm. and they feed directly into each other. And so I think it makes sense. It's, you know, to have that literacy surrounding the way you conduct business.
Okay. So moving on to the next lesson, what is, what's the next one you got for us?
We talked about preloading your understanding for the day. We talked about the retrospectives. I think one of the other things when I look back on 2015 is, and maybe this is, again, just another outgrowth of having that space for thought that you were just talking about, is making sure that you always have a kind of a plan B for inspiration. So I know that I started out at the beginning of the year not really knowing what the hell I was even doing. I mean, it's hard to describe because I'm not in that place right now. But I just wasn't quite sure what I should be working on, and what was kind of the next thing, and what were the problems that I needed to be solving? Like what were the things that I needed to be attaching myself to?
You mean
to
work-wise really or pushing. In your life?
Work-wise. Yeah, no, work-wise. And having that room to explore, having the space and the room that we set up here, you know, allows you to kind of catch ideas that are going to inspire you as they come by. Otherwise, you're going to have your head down, you're going to be looking at the floor, and, you know, something that might be, you know, completely inspiring and very important to you, you know, is going to walk right on by. So for example, in my case, you know, I started out the year not really knowing what I was doing, but being okay with that and just trying to remember to be open and just maintain kind of a general openness so that when something does come by, you can grab it. In this case, it was definitely the immutability and the functional programming as they pertain to UI for me personally. And so I remember telling Stanley, like, at the beginning of the year, I was like, I think this is, you know, when it happened, I told him, I think this is what my year is kind of going to be about. And, you know, then kind of the pace switched to, like, you know, around summertime or just around, really it was in the fall, more to like a very feverish pace of like heads down. And now you get kind of caught by that inspiration. And, you know, now I'm definitely, I won't say closed to other forms of inspiration, but, you know, I'm very much focused on exploring the surface of this idea thoroughly. Mm-hmm. And not really interested in picking up other things. I mean, I am, but right now I really, really, really want to map out this terrain and find out what it means for me, what it means for our company, what it means for the kind of the programming circles that we run in. And I guess my ultimate point is like I was experiencing a lot of anxiety at the beginning of the year for not being in that place mm-hmm. that I am now. Does that make sense?
It does. I think so you were like not necessarily being respectful of the fact that it ebbs and flows.
Yes.
And it's modal.
Absolutely. Yes. And it's modal. It's precisely, and it's actually, I am here now only because I was a blank slate 6 months prior. Does that make sense? Or I was an open book.
Well, as a person who read a blog post about neuroscience once, the brain has modes in it, and the two modes are open mode and closed mode, right? And so we toggle between them many times a day, but there's the small ebb and flow of understanding, you know, what you have energy for at a certain time or what you feel like doing. But also, like, I never really thought about it in these wavelengths of, like, over the course of years or even decades. But, like, you spent, you know, the early part, the first half of a year in open mode, like, gathering information and understanding about this thing that intrigues you in some way and not knowing how to make that concrete yet. And then you spent the last few months with the team making that extremely concrete and diving deeply into it so you went from this very broad survey down to this very focused drill down into the topic. So,
yeah. And it felt very frustrating because like nothing worked, you know, at the top of the year, you're kind of tapping around the big ideas and, you know, because you're not at that concrete level, you're not, you know, I don't know. It doesn't feel frictionless. It feels very massive, very inertial, and it's hard to get things moving.
I wonder how much of that is sort of like American, Western and American thinking that is like, we respect closed mode a lot. We really respect people that get things done, and we respect seeing things ship. And, you know, we have this sort of like Protestant work ethic thing going where you should ship even when you don't feel like it. And in more Eastern philosophies, there's a lot more respect paid to this open mode of being quiet and still and surveying and understanding and patience. And I think so when you felt a lot of that frustration, I wonder how much of that is like the social expectation that you're supposed to be doing something right now. You're supposed to have focus instead of just being okay with the fact that you don't yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And realizing that, I mean, it can literally take months, you know? Yeah. And I think as the level of difficulty, the problems that you are trying to tackle grows, so does the wavelength of these cycles. And so it pays to be mindful of that sometimes the cycles can be years. And so you might experience a fallow period of 6 months or a year. Who knows? If you're, you know, if you're Lao Tzu, it might be a decade.
Yeah. I spent so much of my time learning how to program for 4 or 5 solid years that I read literally nothing that wasn't, unless it was a technical book about how to program in some way or other. And I burned out about 18 months ago so badly I could no longer pick one up. And I started reading other things, and I was like, oh, there are other things out there. And for some people, that might not be considered balance, but I think if you can like amortize that over the course of a decade, that seems, so far it's kind of worked out. It's worked out okay. I get to watch Netflix now.
Yeah, I think I've actually come to have a little bit more nuanced view of balance this year, in the sense that I think balance is definitely relative. I think, you know, we've had certainly throughout my career had, and I guess I'm veering off topic here, but I think it's also something that has I've felt, but has crystallized a little bit here in 2015, is that there are two reasons that you will become, that you'll really put your nose to the grindstone when it comes to programming, staying up late nights and doing things. And I think one of them is when you're so gripped by a problem that it just seizes every bit of your attention and kind of really just gets inside you and causes you to become obsessed, then staying up late and maybe pushing things off for this other thing or this problem and really kind of directing your thinking in favor of this one problem, I think that might actually be healthy. Whereas if you're staying up and you're, you know, working 80-hour weeks and doing this stuff so that you can meet somebody else's expectation, I think that, you know, as we know, that's pretty unhealthy, or I think it's unhealthy. But I think that a lot of times there's not the distinction made. It's like if you're working 80-hour weeks, you don't have balance in your life. Or, you know, if you're working 100-hour weeks, you don't have balance in your life. Well, maybe you don't at that point, because you have to sleep at some point. But if you're obsessed with a problem, it might be actually for very healthy reasons.
Yeah, it's obviously
and solving for personality type and all that stuff.
Yep. Yeah, it can be difficult to like allow that in your own life. Like, it can be difficult to look at that as something that could potentially be positive when everybody's like yelling at you to, I don't know. There's a big sort of counter movement to like find balance by somebody else's definition. And so being able to define that for yourself takes a really long time to figure out what that means for you.
Yeah. It's a more subtle question than I originally thought. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's not just about going home at 5.
Yeah. Although for me, pretty much it is, but there's, you know,
well, for you, that's a component. That's very much a component for me. Less so. It's actually more about my time away from the office is on a daily basis, you know, like I don't know. I guess I'm still figuring out what it means.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's definitely, it's not even a fine tooth comb. It's like a molecular comb or a molecular brush that you have to paint with.
I want to pull one more off the stack here. I have literally a list of about 15 things that I learned this year. Maybe I'll like wrap it up into a blog post or something, but I wouldn't count on it. So I'm trying to decide which one of these was the more impactful. And I'm going to say it's this last one. So the point that I want to discuss is there are people out there that say you must follow your passion. And there are people that say that argument is bullshit. And I have come to side with the second. I have come to side with the argument that follow your passion. It is well-meaning but pretty hollow. My experience this year has really showed me that you discover your passion in the course of trying something that terrifies you. And so try something terrifying doesn't sell as many finely lettered posters on Pinterest as follow your passion. But I think my experience this year has really showed me that if you straight up go after something that really terrifies you and you are open to feedback and change, you will steer that. And it's like becomes a ship of discovery to discover something that resonates with you and that you care deeply about. You don't have to sail out with a mission to discover the specific uncharted territory. You set out to just do something that's kind of scary and new and different. And over the course of that, you start steering that toward lessons and towards a sense of purpose that starts to dawn on you over the course of that trip.
Yeah, well, I think the idea that your passion is going to be self-evident from the get-go is ludicrous. Your passion is everywhere, and you probably have, there's literally thousands of them out there sprinkled throughout the world that you have yet to discover.
Yeah.
And so the idea that you've got this one thing that's your thing and you're going to take it with you and move it to some point B, it doesn't really jibe with reality, does it?
Well, we create this myth, though, of these sort of like, I don't know, these heroes that are driven by, you know, single-minded purpose to, you know, create something very specific or solve a very specific problems, and they dedicate their entire lives to it. But my guess is that most of those people sort of discovered it by accident. Like, I think if Steve Jobs hadn't discovered technology, he would have been, you know, could have been like, I have a passion for teaching philosophy to, you know, to junior high school kids, and I'm going to be the best damn junior high school philosophy teacher ever. Like, whatever that wound up being for him, I think this idea of us having to discover some destiny is bananas. And
yeah,
but the act is that uncovers it is doing something that scares you. And I've talked to a lot of people recently who have done really scary stuff, walked away from a moderately promising career. I went to lunch today with somebody who left a career in molecular biology that their parents were super proud of them over, and and decided this isn't really fulfilling me and I'd really like to try something different, and bounced out of that whole career track to try to start over as a software developer. And I cannot imagine that that was like, you know, I bet that's a thing that continues to frighten them. I just, everything that good that has occurred over the last year has been the result of like kind of just picking up little bits of thread on like, wow, you know what? This is something that we could do that feels like the right thing to do. And it's culminated in something that I actually have, it's starting to grow into something for me that feels like a mission for my life.
Yeah. I've definitely seen that transformation, certainly in you and in kind of the way you've been thinking about things.
Did you see my crazy wall I have where it's like a bunch of pieces of yarn connecting all the people? I've seen a transformation in your thinking. And have you seen a beautiful mind? I'm a little concerned.
Well, no, I mean, what I mean is in terms of, you know, I guess if you weren't working at a software, like, I think that certainly the stuff that you're doing here and, you know, the stuff we've been talking about in the podcast could be done at certainly another company that wasn't a software company. But the fact remains that you're doing it here. And I guess the thing is like, you know, I kind of read that at the beginning of the year, for example, you were kind of like, I don't know if I'm like, you know, if doing like software is like for me, you know what I mean? There was like kind of, you know, I don't know if you, I'm sure you remember this. I hope you don't mind me airing it.
Oh, no, let's do. I don't.
But, you know, you're like, really, there was kind of this crisis of, you know, is a career in software development really, you know, what it is that, you know, I'm cut out for? Is that my passion to be like a software developer or to even work in a software development company? And I think like, you know, the answer might be no, but it might also be yes, in the sense that, you know, you're kind of finding a way finding the thing that's really interesting that kind of is transcendental above software.
It's interesting that you and I were both in that same sort of open mode where it was like, well, I'm vaguely dissatisfied with the status of things as they are, and I'm open to a solution, but I don't see it, and I really don't like not knowing what it is.
Yeah, no, it is. Man.
Yeah, and so you found, you know, you found a style of programming that solves entire classes of problems elegantly in a way that have sort of battled, you know, you've had to battle with for years, and sort of actually pushing a unification of that style, of bringing some of the flavor of that stuff to programming in a way that I find really impressive. And I think it's very cutting edge for the Ember community and the JavaScript community in general. The way that things compose together and the way that, like, sort of, again, it's kind of, I think Trek gave me a glimpse of that future, a potential beautiful future a couple years ago, but I haven't seen anything like that come to fruition until you started doing this work. And it's like, oh, I guess Charles is just going to have to do the work in order to have this future happen. And for me, it is like, well, the reason that we have this company is the company that we wanted to work for didn't really exist as far as we saw. If it did, we'd probably just work there. And so like the mission was, well, let's create the company we wanted to work for. And then we kind of did it. It kind of happened, Charles. Like that happened in 2015, that we now get to work at the place that we always like, we initially set out to do. Like, okay, well, what does that mean? Does it mean anything? Or was it just an exercise? Like, well, it's meaningful to the people that work here, but like, is there a way to tie that to something? And so basically being able to kind of put a label on it and say, okay, what does a humane workplace look like to me? And by define that by action, define that by seeing how we behave in times of stress and how we behave and how to actually apply the things that we believe in, stuff we've seen that we don't like, and the stuff that we wish we saw, roll that up into a company that has to actually make payroll every month and see which parts fit reality and which don't, and go, okay, here is a model for building a humane workplace that treats its people like human beings. And then I think honestly, 2016 for me, if I was going to test drive it, is going to be about evangelizing, defining modifying and evangelizing that model to see if other people will carry that forward.
Mm.
It's been an interesting year, dude.
I can't wait to see it. You know, just hearing that makes me realize I do actually have a final lesson,
okay,
which is if you're going to go into business with Brandon Hayes.
Oh, man. I say that about you all the time.
So there you go.
I do. I actually, that was one thing I didn't get to bring up, but it is about picking people to work with. The most important thing is, does this person share your values? Like, do we share a set of values, or are you going to be working at cross purposes the entire time?
Mm-hmm.
And the shared value that you and I have of really, in almost all circumstances, insofar as it's humanly possible, to try to put the other person in the relationship first. That has served us very, very well, I think, unless I actually am secretly a sociopath.
No, it definitely has.
It served me very well.
And you know, it's great to have that and also have it work to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
Like to actually have those two things. I think that's about all you can ask
for. Well, it's turned into great. So it turns out better software. It turns out people who are strong in the community. Like everything we had been like, oh, if we could like force people to adopt, a model for being a part of a community and being a great software developer, but you can't force all that stuff. But there's something about starting with shared values and trying to stick to your principles and be a good example and use that draw methodology rather than get out behind and push. It's really cool to see the net effect of that result in an actual business that ships great software and accomplishes its temporal mission for keeping food on the table for people, as well as its like higher purpose as far as we see it. That was a grand experiment 2 years ago. We didn't know if it would actually work. And it seems so far it seems to be, which is a pleasant surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, it's about all you can ask for.
Well, it's going to be a great holiday. And I'm glad to take this, 44 minutes to reflect with you.
And, yeah. Thanks, man. It's been a great year.
Yeah, it has.
Thank you. Thank you for 2015.
Thank you for a wonderful, wonderful last couple years, man. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. I'll see you next year.
All right. Okay. See you next year.
Yes.
Bye.